This is Yale Explores, a community of lifelong learners coming together to examine and address the issues shaping our world and the biggest challenges of our time, so we can deepen our understanding today, teach and inspire the leaders of tomorrow, and innovate, collaborate, and accelerate positive change year after year after year. Drawing on the rich resources and heritage of Yale University and fueled by its faculty, students, and alumni, the thinkers, the doers, the creators, the discoverers, the boundary breakers, the difference makers, those committed to leading and serving, those who never stop exploring. This is Yale Explores. Welcome.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome class of 1988 and president of the Yale Club of Boston, Jennifer Madar.
Good evening. It is wonderful to see so many alumni, parents, and friends here tonight. You're all proof that the Yale community in the Boston area is thriving, so thank you so much for being here. As was mentioned, I have the privilege of serving as the president of the Yale Club of Boston, also known as Yale Boston. And on behalf of club leadership, I am absolutely delighted to welcome you to this Yale Explorers event. We brought some printed material about the club, and we hope that you will help yourself to some of it on your way home tonight. If you're not already a Yale Boston member, we encourage you to get involved. We plan many events throughout the year. For instance, we just had a really great event at the Red Sox game, even though we lost, but that's okay. And we participated in the Yale Day of Service with a lot of gusto, so great there. So all of our upcoming events and details on how to get involved can be found on our website at yaleboston.org. So we hope you'll check out our website, and we look forward to seeing you at some of our events. So anyway, I hope you enjoyed the reception tonight as much as I did, you know, connecting with old friends, meeting new Yalies, and I hope that you'll stay after the program for more food, beverages, and discussion. Don't forget, if you haven't already, to record your thoughts in the Yale Explorers story booth. Please use the hashtag Yale Explorers, because everything's got a hashtag now, to post pictures and comments on social media. And with that, the work of tonight's presenters exemplifies the groundbreaking interdisciplinary collaborations that are a hallmark of Yale. Akiko Iwasaki is a newly elected member of the National Academy of Sciences at Yale. She is the Waldemar von Zedwitz Professor of Immunobiology and Professor of Molecular, Cellular, and Developmental Biology. Her research focuses on mechanisms of immune defense against viruses. Mark Saltzman is a newly elected member of the National Academy of Engineering. He is Goizueta Foundation Professor of Biomedical Engineering and Professor of Cellular and Molecular Physiology and Chemical Engineering. He's also the head of Jonathan Edwards College. Professor Saltzman is motivated by the desire to create more effective medical and surgical therapies, and he focuses on tissue engineering and on creating better methods for drug delivery. Peter Shulam is the chair of the Department of Urology at Yale, specializing in laparoscopic and robotic surgery. Dr. Shulam has built a patient-centered program at Yale that provides patients with state-of-the-art diagnoses and treatments. Tonight's moderator, Carl Zimmer, is Yale College class of 1987, and he's an award-winning science columnist for the New York Times. At Yale, Mr. Zimmer is an adjunct professor of biophysics and biochemistry. And he teaches writing about science, medicine, and the environment. We're also, of course, fortunate to have President Peter Salovey with us here tonight. He will close the discussion with insights on tonight's topic from the perspective of a social psychologist. and he'll highlight Yale's unique ability to play a vital role in addressing the pressing challenges facing our world. And so, without further ado, please join me in welcoming Mr. Zimmer and Professors Iwasaki, Saltzman, and Shulam to the stage for Yale Explores, The Quest for Better Therapies.
Thank you, Jennifer, and thank you all for coming and braving the elements tonight. So to my left is, just so you know, Dr. Shulam and Akiko Iwasaki next to Peter, and then Mark Saltzman to my far left. So tonight we're going to the title of the evening is A Quest for New Therapies, and you know Yale is really is the home of thousands of researchers who are all investigating basic biology and then trying to find ways to use that knowledge to make us all healthier. We could talk about all sorts of things tonight, but we decided to focus our conversation specifically on one of the biggest threats to health, which is cancer. According to the National Cancer Institute, over 1.7 million people will be diagnosed in the United States alone with cancer this year. Over 609,000 people will die of cancer. So obviously, this is one of our top priorities in terms of trying to find better therapies. And I'm here with three people who are intimately involved in cutting-edge research at Yale into cancer. It is taking a lot of interesting, surprising directions, things you might not be familiar with at all. And we're going to talk about the ways in which Yale is trying to create an environment to promote that sort of innovation, that creative thinking, and actually try to get that into the clinic. I thought we'd start. Peter, maybe you could help us out here, since you are you're the person here among us who actually deals with patients with cancer every day. And you know, maybe it would be a good place to start to just to talk about the basics of cancer. So on a fundamental level, when we're talking about coming up with better therapies for cancer, what is it exactly that we're fighting? I mean, what is sure. cancer ultimately?
Sure, and I think this will provide a good framework for both what Mark and Akiko will talk about. So simply put, at the 50,000 foot level, cancer is basically unregulated cell growth. And so any cell in your body, if it goes astray, can become a tumor at first. And the question then becomes, what type of tumor? There's benign and malignant. A benign tumor is unregulated cell growth, but it's something that's easily treated, so it can usually be removed and doesn't recur. A malignant tumor, so cancer, unfortunately has unregulated cell growth that also can metastasize, invade other organs, and eventually kill the host or kill the patient. The question is, how does that happen? So it's cells in our body that become dysregulated, and usually it's basically because of an alteration or mutation in the gene, so it can either be a genetic event or an epigenetic event. Genetic event meaning the actual code gets switched, or an epigenetic event means that there's something that happens to the DNA, and it's conformation. So it can be hypermethylation, for instance. So now what happens...
So we're talking about ways in which the DNA is being controlled inside of the cell?
Exactly.
So it's the same DNA, it's used differently?
It has a different conformation. So histones, ways that can be activated, or methylation. So that or just genetic rearrangements can then lead to a mutation. And it can lead to a mutation in a gene. And let's just make it simple. There are two types of genes, proto-oncogenes. So proto-oncogenes basically give you cell growth. And so think of that as the gas pedal, which normally you want, because the normal cycle of a cell is to grow, divide, and also to differentiate. That means a cell takes on the function of the organ that it's in, so a liver cell or a bladder cell. And then eventually, with age, it undergoes cell death and apoptosis. So that's the cell cycle. Dysregulation means that it's no longer following that normal cycle. And if the mutation leads to a change in a proto-oncogene, which basically is the accelerator for cell growth, now you have the cell stepping on the gas pedal uncontrollably. Or you can actually get a mutation in a tumor suppressor gene, which are genes in the body that control cells from going out of control. That's the brake. So cancer, basically, you either lose control of the pedal, so you're pressing the pedal to the metal, or you basically lose control of the brake. And those are the two ways, essentially, how this occurs. And we have five ways of treating cancer. So the blunt force way, which is what I do, is surgery. So we just remove it. We have radiotherapy. Then we have chemotherapy, and this is where the work of Mark and Akiko come in. We have chemotherapy, then we have targeted therapy, and now our new and our fifth pillar in treatment of cancer is immunotherapy. And I think we'll talk a little bit about those as we carry on. But that's kind of the overview of cancer.
I mean, and to be fair, I mean, cancer, the overall cancer death rate has gone down pretty remarkably. I was just looking at the statistics since 1990. In the United States, has gone down by 25%. And so is that because of sort of better use of these more traditional techniques like surgery and chemotherapy? Or are you just getting better at that stuff?
So it's a combination of things. Number one, and we can't forget, is screening. So finding those who have cancer early on, that actually helps decrease the incidence of death related to cancer or mortality. And then other things are our therapies that exist today. And one of the things I like to think about is I look at prostate cancer, and we're doing a very good job with surveillance, even though there's controversy around that, and that's definitely a discussion over several drinks. But if you look at what we've done, we really changed the incidence of cancer, prostate cancer death in the United States since we started screening in 1995. But in addition, some of the drugs that we have available to us now have really changed the course of those who have metastatic or cancer that's outside the prostate. And to your point, men are not dying from it, but they're living with it. And it's essentially, it's kind of an evolution. We're taking cancer and making it more of a chronic disease. You may not necessarily be cured, but we're not changing your life expectancy.
And so then for in terms of the where it's the current medicine is not doing as much as you would like, I mean, what accounts for, say, chemotherapy failing or these other more traditional techniques not being able to cure people? Why don't they get the job done?
I'll just give you a primer, but I think Akiko and Mark can do a much better job. But I'm just going to... So chemotherapy, if you look at the three ways in which we can treat cancer, chemotherapy basically affects cells in the body that are rapidly producing. That's cancer cells, right? They're unregulated cell growth. Guess what it also gets is though there are cells in our body that are rapidly producing normally, hair cells, cells in our GI tract. So chemotherapy is basically like a shotgun approach. It just gets all rapidly producing cells. So we do a very good, it's very effective at killing cancer, but at the same time, it actually destroys the host as well. The patient can feel the effects. The next iteration in our development of treatment for cancer was targeted therapies. So those mutations create driver mutations or changes in signal pathways, and now you can target just that pathway. So now you're going to try to have basically a knife to really dissect where the cell is actually going wrong. So hopefully the cells that are not affected by the mutation will not be affected by the drug. That's not really the case, but it's better. The problem is cancer is smart, and so it can actually mutate, and the drug may no longer be effective. And then the third area that's probably the newest and where Yale has played a great role is in immunotherapy. Just the most recent story that I think is the most impactful is we've all heard about checkpoint inhibitors. So this is beginning to understand the human immune system and realizing that our bodies are made such that we have to fight bacteria and viruses. But at the same time, we don't want to fight ourselves, right? So if we start to recognize ourselves as foreign, things like autoimmune disease occurs. So the body is smart and the immune system, and now I'm into Akika's area, so now I'm nervous myself. The body itself has a system which is called Program Cell Death 1 and PDL1. So it's basically a checkpoint of basically controlling the immune system. And we have since learned...
So to hold the immune system back. You don't want the immune system to get
basically
too crazy.
To turn off the immune system so that it doesn't react to that particular antigen or that protein, so it doesn't recognize. So that you can see that protective for the human body so that we don't recognize self. Well, unfortunately, cancer has learned that it can actually use that in its favor. So when it starts to grow and rapidly produce, and there are proteins on the cell surface that we may recognize as foreign, it can increase the expression of PD-1, so basically that break for the immune system, and use our own immune system to prevent from killing the cancer. What we've learned is if we take antibodies, which are little proteins, think of it as an umbrella over a receptor, so you block it so that now the immune system can't see that protein, that PD-1 programmed cell death protein on the cancer, we can now have the activation of the immune system, and we can actually kill the cancer with our own immune system. And this was all described around 2014. We have a very strong immunotherapy group with Liping Chen, who did a lot of this. He described the PD-1 ligand, one of many. We've done a lot of research in the last several years, and we've had some of the seminal papers at Yale, which was quite exciting, from the Cancer Center in around 2014, demonstrating the effects of these immunotherapies for lung and bladder cancer.
So, Mark, I wanted to get you to talk a bit about your own work, because you're coming from such a different perspective. I mean, you're not a cancer doctor. You're not an immunobiologist. You're an engineer. I mean, I think that would be fair enough to say.
Yes, I am an engineer.
You're an engineer. So, so what's an engineer doing to fight cancer? Let me put it this way. How did an engineer end up in the fight against cancer?
So I'm a chemical engineer by training, and chemical engineers make new chemicals. They make processes to make chemicals. They also make materials. It's a big part of chemical engineering. And some people call the last century the century of plastic because chemical engineers and others learned how to make polymers, high molecular weight molecules that can be used as materials. So not all chairs now are made of wood. Many are made of plastic, and plastics can be made to hold you off the ground just as well as wood can. And that's relatively new and the work of chemical engineers. But there's a growing category of chemical engineers who are interested in applying those kinds of skills to solving problems in medicine. And that's my particular specialty. So we've learned how to use some of these polymers that are like other polymers, and you can manufacture them, and they are materials, and you can make stuff out of them, but they have some interesting properties. They're degradable. So if you implant them in the body, they will slowly disappear. And they're biocompatible, so you can implant them in the body and they don't cause any bad interactions. And so what we've done is take these materials that have those two properties and embed chemotherapy drugs. And there's lots of chemotherapy drugs that work very well at killing cancer cells and stopping their growth. The problem is when you take them in the usual ways, they go all over your body and they cause these side effects. And often the amount of drug a doctor will give you is determined not by what is good to treat your tumor, but by what gives you acceptable side effects.
You mean that you're taking it
by a pill or by an injection,
and you just got to flood your whole body.
It goes all over the body.
Even if you just want to treat just your liver or your brain, say.
So we started testing the idea that one could put chemotherapy drugs in polymers and make them into materials that we would give to surgeons who are operating to remove a brain tumor, for example. And when they took out as much of the brain tumor as they felt they could do safely, they then put our materials back in the resection cavity.
So what should we picture? What is this object that you're?
So in this case, it's about the size of a dime. The ones that we finally made, we explored lots of different kinds of shapes and sizes, but it's about the size of a dime, and it has it's mainly this polymer that dissolves slowly and that is inert. But it's 4% of a chemotherapy drug. And when you put it in the brain, the chemotherapy drug slowly released. And it's released right at the site where these tumor cells are still remaining. And the idea is to bathe the tumor site with chemotherapy. It doesn't go into the rest of the body because it's all held in this polymer, and so it's delivered locally. And so that was the first product that we were involved with, and that became approved by the FDA in 1996. It's called Gliadel, and it's used to treat the most aggressive kinds of brain cancers. And in the years since then, we've been trying to do two things. One is to make these materials in different kinds of ways that are suitable for treating other kinds of cancers, including brain cancer, and then to test them. And for me, an engineer, to test them, the best way to do that is to collaborate with physician scientists like Dr. Shulam, or biological scientists like Dr. Iwasaki, And you can really make rapid progress that way, we making materials in our laboratory and getting insights from clinicians and from biologists.
And so where have you gone from that sort of dime-sized device? Like, have you been exploring?
Can we show the picture?
Yeah, actually, that's great. If you could, I totally forgot. We have a picture. Voila. So we. This is not the size of a dime, right? So give us a sense of how big this is and what we're looking at.
So these are cancer cells, and what you see, these are cancer cells, and this is a microscopic image. So each cell is about 50 microns in diameter, and so you could see this with the human eye. You couldn't see it very well with the human eye, but if you had good eyes, you could. And what you see is red is outlining the cell. So you can see there's many cells in this picture. The blue is the nucleus. And the blue, that's where the events that Dr. Shulam was talking about, that's where they happen. That's where mutations
So the DNA
occur.
Is held in the nucleus,
the DNA is
and
all
that's
in
what
the
matters
nucleus.
There.
And the green dots are nanoparticles that we've sort of sprinkled onto these cells, or we've applied to the cells.
So what do you mean by a nanoparticle? What is a nanoparticle?
A nanoparticle is exactly what I described to you before when I talked about the device that was the size of a dime, except it's much, much smaller. It's 100 nanometers or so in diameter, and 100 nanometers is, a hair is about a millimeter in diameter. A microbe, a bacterium, is about a micron in diameter. A virus is 100 nanometers in diameter. So these are tiny, tiny particles that are the size of a virus. They're small enough to go inside of a cell, and you can see in this picture they're small enough to even accumulate in the nucleus. And because they have drugs in them, they can release these drugs right at the site that the cancer is occurring. And so the trick is, can you make these tiny particles and give them in the body in ways that they only go to the cancer cells and they deliver these drugs in the cancer cells?
So what's your trick?
So one trick is relatively straightforward. You go where the cancer cells are. So we're using these to treat brain tumors, and there we infuse them directly into the side of a brain tumor because brain tumors are famous for staying where they are. They grow aggressively locally, but they don't go to other places in the body. So surgeons know when they treat brain tumor that they've left a few tumor cells behind. So instead of putting a big device in, like that dime-sized wafer, we infuse these tiny particles, and they can penetrate into the brain like a virus would, and they can enter tumor cells like this and then deliver their potent compounds. But we're extending it outside the brain as well, but focusing on cancers that you could treat locally, so injecting them intraperitoneally for women that have uterine or ovarian cancer that's spread through their abdominal tract, and they can stay in the place there, injecting them in the prostate, infusing them into the bladder, injecting them into skin cancers locally. So our first mode of targeting is to just put them where you know they need to be. And then the second is to adjust the chemistry of the particle, the outside surface of the particle, so that it likes tumor cells better than it likes other kinds of cells. And we're learning how to do that, sometimes just by simple chemical tricks, sometimes by more complex things using antibodies that recognize tumor cells, like Dr. Shulam referred to.
And I was really intrigued to read a paper you published about sunscreen. Like, so you're getting into sort of cancer protection in a sense as well, right?
So prevention of cancer would be even better than trying to treat this disease that's very difficult to treat. And one of the most prevalent forms of cancer is skin cancer. There's many different kinds of skin cancer, very aggressive kinds like melanoma. And less aggressive, like basal cell carcinoma. And my grandfather, who was a farmer, had lots of basal cell carcinomas over his life that were removed surgically. But some people get them that they're large, or they're in places that are difficult to treat, or you get a bad cosmetic result if you did surgery. So we're making our particles to stick to the skin, so you could treat locally with tumors. But we also found that we could take these particles and put sunscreen ingredients inside of them, and adjust the surface chemistry so that they're very adhesive, such that if you put these particles on your skin, you can't wash them off. And I could talk about the chemistry about how that works, but it's very safe. And our idea is that you could make a sunscreen that stays outside your body. is very effective at absorbing UV light because it's on the surface of your skin and not soaked into your skin, and would last for a long time. So if you have a toddler, you only have to chase them down once a day to put sunscreen on instead of every 80 minutes, which is what the bottle tells you to do. So I actually have some nanoparticles in my bag, and during the reception, I'll show you them if you like.
Yeah. So Akiko, congratulations again on the National Academies. That's great. You do work on the immune system and on viruses, and I'm people may not realize just how important viruses are to the burden of cancer. I mean, we think about UV light, for example, or smoking, but tell us a little bit about why viruses are so important to understand in terms of trying to take on cancer.
Yes, so viruses are actually a major cause of cancer. It's estimated to be about 15% of all cancers are caused by a variety of different viruses. Probably the largest example we know is the human papillomavirus that is a causative agent of cervical cancer, and it also causes oral and throat cancers and penile and vaginal, many different cancers that are caused by this group of viruses, HPV. And there's also another example that we may know about, which is the EBV, Epstein-Barr virus, which is also a causative agent for Burkitt's lymphoma, Hodgkin's lymphoma, and other oral cancers as well. So there's a lot of different viruses that can cause cancer directly.
Yeah, I read somewhere that 15% of all cancer is from viruses. It's amazing.
Yeah.
So when I think of a virus, I think of this little thing that gets into my cells and my nose and gives me a cold and I'm just miserable and I get over it. I don't get cancer. What happens with these particular viruses that goes from just infection to all-out cancer?
Right. So there are different kinds of strategies that viruses like to use. So the ones that you're referring to are called acute infections, where you get a bolus of virus, it replicates in your nose, it makes you miserable for a week, and your immune system can clear the virus. And that kind of viruses are a little bit easier to either treat or prevent or get over, whereas other kinds of viruses cause chronic infection, which means, for example, herpes simplex virus, a virus that I and Mark and I are both very interested in studying, causes latent infection, which basically remains for the rest of your life. And so herpes are forever. So these are like examples of chronic viruses. Mm-hmm. And cancer-causing viruses tend to be chronic viruses. So HPV can hide in the cervix for decades mm-hmm. before causing cancer. Mm-hmm. EBV, the same thing. The B cells that are infected can become latent, and they can stay in the body for many, many years before they become cancers. Hepatitis C virus is another example where you have a chronic infection, and the inflammatory responses to the virus itself may be a causative for oncogenesis in that organ. So there are many ways in which the viruses can cause cancer.
So are there ways to attack cancers caused by viruses or to prevent them that you wouldn't have with some other kind of cancer?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's sort of the focus of my laboratory, because when a virus infects the host cell, the immune system can see the virus because they have distinct proteins in them, and they are called antigens. And so antigens are very distinct from what we make in our own cells. And so we can target those antigens using either antibodies or T cells that see specific amino acid sequences that are only present in viruses. And that's the basis for HPV vaccine, like Gardasil 9, for example. It's based on the fact that our immune system sees these unique features of viruses that are now found in the host. And it's a very effective vaccine, by the way. I'm making sure my daughters are getting these vaccines. It's like 100% efficacy in prevention of cervical cancer and oral cancer for boys, and I think I would recommend it highly. So we have the advantage of taking the information about the virus and making a vaccine against them. So that would be the preventative measure that we can take, as you were saying. It's much better than treating an already existing cancer. And so if we can make vaccines against all oncogenic viruses, that would be amazing. But the other thing we can do is that even once you're infected with the virus and you have developed cervical cancer or you're on your way to developing it, we can also still target those infected cells because we can target those virus-specific antigens, the proteins that are unique to the virus, using T cells and antibody.
So T cells are one of the immune cells?
Yes, T cells are one of the lymphocytes that you can find. It's a white blood cell type, and it's really important in cancer. Cancer immunotherapy is essentially based on T cell killing the cancer cells. Mm-hmm. So what we're doing is taking advantage of the fact that cervical cancers are all caused by HPV virus, and once we're starting a treatment clinical trial for treatment of these precancerous lesions, which have these antigens expressed within those cells, and we're generating T cell response using the vaccine, and then we're trying to recruit those T cells to the site of cancer using another agent. This is a strategy we came up with called prime and pull. Essentially,
So what's the prime part of it?
Okay, prime part of it is to generate the T cell response using the Gardasil vaccine,
and that's just going to be all over your body.
That's right. T cells go everywhere except that they don't enter the right tissue. In this case, the cervix. So if you just vaccinate someone with Gardasil, precancerous lesions with Gardasil, that person is not going to benefit from that at all, because the T cells are not going to find the cancer. But we're helping those T cells find the cancer by injecting another molecule called imiquimod, which is an agonist that's applied to the surface of the cervix, and that allows the small inflammation to occur in that site. And that attracts the T cells that are specific to the virus to come to that site and start recognizing the infected cells and killing them. And so it's...
So you're basically like sending a signal saying, okay, all T cells
that
have this treatment now, please come here.
That's right.
Please report to this site.
Exactly. So we're basically putting flags around that cervix area by injecting this chemical called imiquimod. So we think that it's a much better approach than just priming alone. We know it doesn't work. And pulling alone may help because there's some circulating T cells against the virus. But if you can prime the T cell and then pull them, it might be a much more effective pathway.
And where are you with this testing this out?
So we have a clinical trial ongoing right now with mm-hmm. the Yale Cancer Center. And it was actually a support of the Yale Cancer Center that allowed basic scientists like myself to collaborate with clinicians to start this clinical trial. We're midway through. We're recruiting more patients, in the New Haven area. So I don't really know the results yet, but I'm very excited to find out what happens.
Do you think this basic concept might work on other types of cancers?
Yeah, so that's really ultimately our hope. So we can target virus-specific T cells, fairly easily because we know what the antigen is. Mm-hmm. For most cancers that are not caused by viruses, we don't know what the antigen is. As Peter mentioned, cancer cells are essentially your own cells that are dividing uncontrollably. So there's nothing really unique about them. But for some cancers, actually, there are so many mutations that accumulate that they generate these new types of antigens, and they're called neoantigens. And so if we can find out what neoantigens are expressed by a particular cancer type, we may be able to prime against the neoantigen and then pull using kind of a chemical that I'm talking about.
So would that be, would these new antigens on these cancer cells, would this be sort of a personalized sort of medicine in the sense that you would look at someone's own tumors and say like, ah, you've got this and we're going to target it for this? Or are there kind of, do all cancers mm-hmm. of a type kind of move towards the same antigen and you can just use the same treatment on lots of people?
So both scenarios are possible. Mm-hmm. The personalized medicine approach that you mentioned, it's probably the best approach, because what we would do in that case would be to take the cancer cells out of a patient, sequence the DNA, find the mutations, and predict which of those mutations might fit the T cell receptor well, and then make those neoantigen as vaccines. And that's actually being done already in multiple places, including here in Boston. So those are neoantigen discovery kind of method. But I'm also hoping that there are some cancers that overexpress, you know, antigens that are very common amongst those cancers. And that's another way to target. And in fact, there are therapies for liquid cancers called CAR T therapy, where people have already sort of targeted common antigen on the cancer cells with an antibody.
And when you say liquid cancers, you mean of the bloodstream?
Yes, exactly. Lymphoma and things like that, where you can actually target a cell surface molecule using an antibody, which is attached to a T cell. It's called chimeric antigen receptor. And that can be delivered preferentially towards the cancer cells that are expressing those antigens. And so both of those two ways are a possibility.
Mm. Yeah. So we're hearing about all these fascinating new developments, and how, obviously, this is not the sort of thing that like one lone genius is going to do from start to finish. So how at Yale are you trying to find ways to kind of to come together and combine expertise? How does that work? I don't know if any of you can take that one.
Well, let me just start. So I came to Yale in 2002, and I was already a professor at Cornell University, where they have a fabulous engineering school, and that's what attracted me there, so I could do great engineering. But I was struggling because I couldn't get these things developed kind of past the laboratory because there wasn't the right sets of collaborators there. So that's one of the things that made Yale attractive to me. And there's two aspects to that. One is that Yale's a really it's a complete university. It has a great school of medicine, it has a great school of public health, it has a great school of engineering, school of management, law, others. And that's important. But it also has a culture of people from those different disciplines working together. And so it has all of these individual units, which are excellent, but the boundaries between them are not very high. And I think that's because people that are attracted to faculty positions at Yale want to collaborate. That's part of the reason why they came. And I sort of sensed that from my first visits to campus. That was a very attractive thing to me, to work in that kind of an environment. And it's turned out to be fabulous. Here's two people that I now collaborate with that I couldn't find their counterparts at the university that I was at.
Akiko, how has it been for you?
For me, because I'm not, I didn't specialize as a cancer immunologist. I really started from studying viruses. And so there wasn't a lot of opportunity for me to obtain funding to start a clinical trial. And it was really Yale Cancer Center Discovery Fund that allowed us to start this. And so now I have two amazing clinician scientists, Dr. Sanghini and Dr. Alessandro Santin. It's their effort that I'm supporting. But without that seed fund from the Cancer Center, we couldn't have done this. And of course, it's because we're all collaborative as well. I just basically pitched the idea of this new trial, like prime and pull, might work very well for treating a localized cancer like cervical cancer. And they really bought into it. And they really are dedicating their lives to doing this trial right now. So I think it's collaboration and opportunity for funding.
And Peter, what's it like for cancer doctors, where you're, obviously, like, you're dealing with patients all the time, as we were talking about before, but then you also are working with people who are trying out, totally new ideas that could change the way you do it. So what's your interaction with the basic research scientists?
Yeah. So I had the fortunate opportunity, Carl, for a year and a half, I was the interim director of the Cancer Center. We were in between directors, and I pulled the short straw, I guess. But actually, it was probably the coolest year and a half of my academic career, because I got to see inside the science of cancer. And both Mark and Akiko are very special, because, as you can hear, they're really basic scientists who are translational. So the word translational means that you can take work in the laboratory and actually have impact on patients. What they just described and the fact that they sit on both sides of that fence is actually, that's why they're in the National Academy of Sciences. They're amazingly unique. Yale has a lot of bright people, and some people are very basic. So we have some scientists who really are just looking at signal pathways, and they know that pathway inside and out. They just, when you pull them away from that cell, from that nanometer kind of view, they're completely lost. Like, they don't know where it goes. So that's where you then bridge it with the physician scientist, who now can see the opportunity of that basic science work, so you can go from the bench to the bedside. And I think, you know, that's what we kind of, I think that's why the Cancer Center has done so well. Yale has a strong foundation in research. We now have a strong foundation in clinical translational patient care. And one of the things that we had started, and it's in its infancy, but I realized when I was a Cancer Center director, I looked throughout the campus, and I think this is Peter Salovey's vision, I think it's called One Yale, or it's basically, the bottom line is Yale is huge in a sense. It's small, but it's diverse, and it's heterogeneous. And every piece of the university can benefit the other. And I'm not sure that we always made the connection. And an example was, when I was the Cancer Center director, I asked, how many individuals or scientists are around the campus who are doing cancer drug discovery? And it was amazing what we found. There was actually quite a few of them. And they weren't connected. And to me, they should have all been under the Cancer Center. So we started a center, and it's in its infancy, but it's Cancer Therapeutic Accelerator Program. And people like Craig Cruz, who are in the School of Chemistry, now being intimately connected with the medical school. And what I tell everyone is, what was great about this was we had all these lights of activity, and by coalescing them under the Cancer Center, and we kind of increased the lumens of our own kind of net worth. And it's a spectacular place. So to me, you know, where this happens is we recruit people who are inquisitive. We recruit people who want to work together, that are collaborative. We have great basic scientists. We now have great clinicians. And basically, everyone's there because they're there for the patient, but they're also for the science and the discovery. And it's a unique place.
But how does it work? Does, like, someone, a basic researcher, stand up and say, like, I've got these nanoparticles, and I need somebody to help me? Like, are you, like, is this a matchmaking service?
Or so, you know,
how is this working?
It's, speed dating.
Yeah, there you go.
So, a good example is what Mark and I did. So just to go away from cancer therapeutics for a minute and talk about, there are other ways to have impacts on cancer. So you can have impact basically with devices, with apps, you know, processes, and there's many things that you can look at.
New diagnostics.
So Mark and I met early on when I came to Yale. I met Mark 5-6 years ago now, and we said there's a lot of opportunity around the School of Engineering up on the main campus and the medical school. And so together we came up with the idea for a Center for Biomedical Innovation and Technology. And that's been in existence now for 4 or 5 years, and it does exactly what you're saying. It basically creates a portal for people on the campus, regardless of the school that they're associated with, who think they have an idea that may be a medical device or an app or a diagnostic, and they just don't know how do I incubate this, how do I test it. So we create this center, and what this center does is it provides for them, as they come in, they basically can have, we can do clinical validation, we can do technical support, we can do regulatory support, and we can do business support. These are all 4 separate entities, but what we do is we draw on the expertise of the School of Management, the School of Law, and so we create an incubator. It's a test tube of activity, and actually, not only do we create connections, but the cool thing about this is we actually become multidisciplinary. So all I can tell you is the coolest thing to see is when you have undergraduate students who are interested in engineering working with transplant surgeons to try to think up a new way to create a preservation device for small bowel transplantation. And you see that happening, it's off the charts, because now the student actually has the ear of a transplant surgeon because they have a perspective that they've never had before. So I tell everyone, so that creates creativity, and that's what Yale's about. And so creativity really is finding similarity and dissimilar things, and the best way to do that is to increase the aperture through which we look, and the only way we could do that is for me to work with an immunobiologist or me to work with a bioengineer, because they are going to ask me questions that I haven't thought about in what I'm doing on a daily basis. So that's what we do. that's why we get up every morning. It's kind of exciting.
Do you find it a challenge in like that you, I mean, as a science writer, I know that if I call up different experts, they speak in different languages. So if you are talking with each other, like, is that coming from those different worlds? Can that be a challenge? Like, you know, if you're trying to talk about, you know, some process, I mean, you know, maybe a doctor's like, you know, like, I'm going to stick with my tried and true chemotherapy. I mean, how do you overcome the sort of that language barrier?
So that's something I'm passionate about. And in fact, I took one of your courses on science communication.
Excellent. are you selling books here?
No, but he teaches a course in science communication, which is great because I think all of us scientists should be communicating with the public more often. And so I also actively take on, you know, radio shows or TV shows or whatever in order to communicate science. Because ultimately, our excitement that we feel about science has to be communicated to the public. And that's the way to elevate the entire society, because I think science is so great. And how the society moves forward is really based on scientific discoveries and evidence. So. That's something that I try personally to be able to communicate at a level that everyone can understand. And it takes practice, as you know and as you talk.
Yeah. Right, but I'm sort of curious, like, yeah. I mean, but if you must even have that challenge talking to a doctor, or like, and a doctor mm-hmm. may have some challenges, yeah. like explaining to you what really matters for them. I mean, I'm just wondering if you encounter those
So I think you're absolutely right, and there are for those of us that are at a different part of the learning curve, you know, maybe it's harder to acquire those mm-hmm. things. You know, I was lucky, and this was really influential for me. I was lucky when I was at graduate school. I could take 2 years off from my graduate program. I went to medical school for 2 years, and I learned the main thing I learned was the vocabulary that Peter and his colleagues use every day. I mean, I learned something about human medicine, but I learned how to speak. And so I think we have to, for young people, for Yale students now, you know, they might study chemical engineering, they might study molecular biology, but it's likely that they're going to need to know more than that, much more than that, when they're out in the world. All the problems, the interesting problems, are between things. So mm-hmm. we're trying to find opportunities for students to get out of their disciplinary homes more often. We're doing it with CBIT. We put together a program together with SciCity.
Why don't you unpack those terms for people who are not familiar with them?
CBIT is a center that Peter was just talking about. SciCity is a new entity at Yale that Peter's also the faculty director of, called the Center for Innovative Thinking at Yale. And its purpose is to develop creative thinking skills in students, providing them opportunities where they can learn how to innovate. And one way they can do that is by watching or talking to other people who've been innovators. So we had a little program this semester called an intensive program. No credit for it, but you had to sign up and make a commitment. And for those students who did, we arranged 6 meetings with physician scientists, and they could go spend time in their laboratory, in their clinic, in their operating room, wherever it was they did their work, and students had a chance to talk to them about what they did and what inspired them and what helped them to create new things. And I talked to some of those students after just these 6 sessions, and it's changed their view of their education in some ways. They're hungry to learn more. They're still excited about what they're studying. We haven't converted everybody into pre-med students, but they're excited to learn more because they see that these areas between disciplines are where the excitement is happening.
Just to add on to that, it's just realizing those students who actually were engaged in that were not science students. They may have been from the School of Divinity, the art school. So it was taking people outside of the normal elements. And to go to your question, and I think Akiko's touched on it, you know, look at what we've done in the last 50 minutes here. I think a lot of you learned a little bit about cancer, enough that you could actually probably engage in a discussion. And what I tell everyone is actually thinking about this and actually just thinking about what you were saying, there are two aspects to to innovation. One is the language, so it's understanding what we're talking about using those words, but then creativity. And I think creativity is agnostic. So if I take two individuals of two different disciplines, I believe that the creativity between them is agnostic. I just have to get them to be on the same level playing field with respect to language. And what that requires is what Akiko just said, is we have to kind of come down, figure out where that individual is, get them, you know, kind of get them comfortable, and then bring them back up. And then once you do that, you can begin to have the dialogue. I actually don't think it's that hard. I know I had to learn a lot running the cancer center and working with people like Akiko. I was incredibly intimidated, more so than you can imagine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but after about a year, you realize that really we're all doing the same thing. It's just a little language barrier, but it shouldn't be insurmountable. And I think that's what we're trying to teach the students at Yale, is learn to become comfortable being uncomfortable. And then with that, you know, things start to happen. Because when you run in a particular lane and with the blindfolds on, you miss a lot of the world.
Maybe just to, you know, as we're wrapping things up, maybe each of you, I could get each of you just to kind of look ahead, let's say, 30 years. And I'm just wondering, like, what you think about what cancer treatment will be like then. And I'm not going to hold you to it, like, but I just am curious, like, what do you think about, like, that's happening now that could really potentially be sort of a kind of way of dealing with cancer that we just aren't really familiar with these days, and, you know.
So here's a fact. 80% of cancers are diagnosed in the last one-third, the last one-third stage of the disease. So think about that, right? So now, what would have impact there? So all the work that we're doing with genetic analysis, and if we can start to predict those that are going to actually have the disease before they have it, or it's early on in the disease, then we can have a true impact. So I think, to me, that's going to be one area over the next two decades or so that I think will have some of the greatest impact on our ability. You know, we can sit here and say, yes, we can identify the genetic defect, use CRISPR technology, and replace the gene. Oh, yeah, that's great. Okay, but, you know, realistically, you gave us 30 years, so I'm trying to be realistic. I think our ability to detect the cancer earlier.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Akiko?
It's going to be robots.
Robots? Over here.
Well, I don't think I'm joking, but I think, okay, if you give me the next 10 years... it's a little bit...
Take whatever time you
okay.
want.
Because, you know, the PD-1 therapy that Peter was talking about, it really took about 20 years from basic discovery to FDA approval.
That's a long time.
Yeah. So, unfortunately, I mean, this is becoming shorter and shorter for cancer therapy, but I think, you know, right now what's happening and what's really discovered on a daily basis in immunology of how cancers are recognized, how cancers can be targeted, how cancers are basically detected by the immune system, which is still an unknown fact in the cancer immunology. All these things are going to be translated in the next 10 to 20 years. And so 20 years ago, nobody would have believed that the checkpoint blockade would work. Mm-hmm. Nobody. And right now, cancer vaccine is still sort of a stage where people are still skeptical if it's going to work. I think all those barriers are going to be conquered in the next 10 to 20 years. And so, yeah, it's going to be a chronic disease management problem.
Early diagnosis, chronic disease management with vaccines. Yeah. What do you think?
And it's going to be personalized, right? I think it's going to be, we're going to know more and more through genetics. And I think everybody's immune system is also a little bit different, right? We've been exposed to different things throughout our lives, and we're going to figure out ways to fingerprint that too. I'm sure maybe we already know those. So in the shorter term, I think we have to think about better ways to combine all the things that we know how to do. We know how to do surgery. We know how to use chemotherapy. We know how to use radiation therapy. But using all those immunotherapy now, we're starting to learn how to use. We need to figure out how to use them all safely in the right amounts in each individual setting, and to really offer all the options to someone, not to be so narrowly focused on this is the sort of state of the art for one thing. And the reason you don't, I suppose, is because they all carry risks and toxicities with them, and so combining them into one package safely is going to be critical, and that's going to require personalization, I think.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Just one thing. The other thing that I think we're getting very good with our diagnostic tests, so we talk about genetics. And so remember, to sequence the genome at one point, I don't know how many years ago, was $1 million for the one genome. Now we can do it for 1,000. So what does that do? That gives us a lot of data. So we have a lot of genetic data. We have proteomics, metabolomics. We have all this work. And so we now have these big data sets. And data really is nothing, but we want to convert data into knowledge. And so how do we do that? Because we can't have a human looking at all this to try to see where the similarities lie. So I think the future, the next decade or so, I think, you know, AI, machine learning, neural networks are going to be hugely important in helping us take all that we learn about genetics and proteomics and, you know, even immunology to understand. And, you know, to Mark's point, looking at a series of 1,000 patients who received PD-1, who responded and who didn't, we don't really know why. But if we can somehow sift through the layers of data that we have, and it may be the microbiome of the gut, which we've learned and actually can have an effect on immunotherapy. Things like that will be able to bring forward to the future. So we won't rely so much on, you know, fortuitous kind of stumbling over the rock, but actually these data sets providing knowledge for us.
Great. Well, I'm sure that Peter and Akiko and Mark will be happy to continue the conversation through the reception and maybe even get to see some nanoparticles. But let's just give a hand to our panelists and thank them. Thanks. Yeah, you guys can sit down. I'll stand. Thank you. And now I'd like to welcome to the stage President Salovey, who will give some concluding remarks.
Thank you. Well, good evening, everyone. It's so great to see all of you here in Boston. Thanks for joining us. Wasn't it exciting to have Carl Zimmer as a guide for tonight's exploration? Thank you for doing that. And our three professors, Mark and Akiko and Peter, thank you so much. That was really great. So this was a discussion that I think illustrates Yale knowledge, Yale research, Yale expertise, all brought to bear for understanding and trying to solve a contemporary challenge in medicine. And I want to take a minute, in a couple of minutes, to share some thoughts that actually came out of my own lab. I know that seems like a funny thing for the president to do, but you might find it interesting. And of course, I'm interested in your thoughts about all this, so we'll have some time during the reception after the session in just a few minutes. For me to hear your ideas and to share ideas further. Tonight, we had professors from the Yale School of Engineering and Applied Science, Mark, from the School of Medicine, Immunology, from the School of Medicine, Surgery, and they spoke about how to improve the lives of patients, improve the lives of their families. And their remarkable contributions to science, to medicine, demonstrate that it takes collective knowledge across disciplinary boundaries to make a dent on a problem like cancer. So when we move across boundaries, what are we doing? We're moving across schools at Yale. We're breaking down those barriers. And that's what it's going to take, I think, to cure many of the diseases that that we face in the contemporary world. Well, what does that illustrate? It shows us that interdisciplinary collaboration can take a groundbreaking discovery from the laboratory and bring it to the clinic. Peter used the phrase that's often used, from bench to bedside. And we know that to make a dent, to make major discoveries in the area of cancer therapeutics, we're going to require insights from molecular biology to surgery, from looking at what's happening in a single cell to looking at what's happening in a whole human being. Okay, well, my field is social psychology. And some of you probably took my introductory psychology course where I talked about social psychology. And actually, my field has something to say in this area. This may surprise you. No, we don't study nanoparticles or the immune system or even do surgery, not intentionally anyway. And we do study the prevention of disease and the treatment of disease. How do we do that? Well, once a scientific discovery has been integrated into clinical practice, the path to better health is not guaranteed. It doesn't end there. Whether a patient adheres to a new treatment or to a prevention protocol is a major determinant of whether that treatment, that intervention, is going to have the desired impact. And that's where social psychology comes in. Adherence is a topic that we study. So according to the World Health Organization, the rate of adherence to a medical therapy in the developed world is about 50%, right? It's only about 50%. And so when individuals do not adhere to their treatment, their disease progresses, and much of the work that went into developing these therapies at the basic translational and applied levels, in a sense, is wasted. At least on them. In our country today, we think there are about 25,000 deaths every year directly attributed to failure to adhere to a treatment regimen. About 10% of all hospitalizations are probably failures to adhere. And the cost is somewhere between $100 and $289 billion every year. Now imagine if you had that, imagine if everybody adhered and you had $289 billion to invest into research on new therapies, right? We'd make a lot of progress. Well, why does that happen? Well, there are many reasons why patients may not adhere to a therapy protocol or a prevention protocol. Maybe there's poor communication between the healthcare provider and the patient. Maybe the patient has limited access to information. Maybe it's just a complex, complicated regimen, and it's just hard to figure out what to do and to do it correctly. Well, in my lab, and I don't run this lab anymore, I'm afraid to say, but up until a few years ago, I ran a lab called the Health, Emotion, and Behavior Lab. We were funded by the National Cancer Institute, and I was a member of the Cancer Center that Peter directed for a year and a half. We looked at how do you frame information in ways that are more likely to get people to adhere to a recommendation, to, in this case, usually to a prevention protocol. Now, we can look at how framing affects prevention, early detection, right? Many things you can look at with message framing. Now, with message framing, what do we mean? What I mean is, very simply, you can frame information in terms of gains. Here are the good things that'll happen if you do this behavior. Or you can frame them in terms of loss. Here are the terrible things that will happen if you don't do that behavior. Right? Those are two different messages, about equivalent in content, but framed differently. So a game frame message might be, to use something that is close to Mark's heart, if you use sunscreen when you go to the beach, you're more likely to keep your skin healthy and your life long. That was all game frame, positive outcomes from using sunscreen. I can do the same message in a loss frame version. If you don't use sunscreen when you go to the beach, you're more likely to have unhealthy skin and you could die of skin cancer. Right? Basically the same information, but now I'm focusing on the costs, the negative consequences of not doing the behavior. Well, we did all kinds of field experiments to try to see which of these messages worked better. We looked at, we did brochures and posters and videos and with differently framed messages, whole campaign, public health campaigns that lasted for a year, and randomly assigned people to gain or loss frame conditions. And you can do that in New Haven very easily because we can work in public housing and randomly assign people who lived in one building to one condition and in another building to a different condition. So each building had its own public health campaign. Anyway, what we found in looking at endpoints like smoking cessation or sunscreen use or mammography screening or pap testing, what we discovered was that when we emphasize gains, the positive consequences, right? We were better able to promote prevention behaviors. That worked better than losses. And when we emphasize losses, the negative, the costs, it worked better for early detection behaviors than GainFrame did. So if you're trying to promote sunblock use at the beach, GainFrame. If you're trying to promote mammography or pap testing, LossFrame. Well, okay, the complexities of treating or preventing cancer, let alone Alzheimer's or autoimmune diseases or other illnesses, it's not going to be addressed by a single discipline. That is clear. It's not going to be addressed by one Yale department or one Yale school successfully. We're going to need leaders in engineering, in the social sciences, in the natural sciences, in medicine, in public health, in nursing, to work together. And that's where a great research university like Yale can play an important role. Yale plays a vital role in bringing together experts to work collaboratively. You just heard great examples of it today. To work collaboratively to improve lives. That is something we can do. So we're conducting cutting-edge research in many different fields. And when our students participate with us, when they talk to us, when they hear about the results of this research in the classroom, what are we doing? We're helping them become agile thinkers. We're helping them develop into the leaders who can thrive and lead in a fast-changing world. And they're going to go on and make remarkable contributions, whether they do what we do or do something quite different. They're going to make remarkable contributions in their professions, in their communities. And this is just what Yale alumni have done for generations, and it's what you do every day. And for those efforts, for the work of Yale alumni that reaches every part of the world, we can be grateful because you demonstrate that Yale's enriching educational environment on campus actually leaves campus and extends beyond it, extends out to the entire world. You know that for us to find better treatments for cancer and address other global challenges, we have to reach beyond the boundaries of our campus, right? We have to broaden our horizons. And as alumni, you do that for us. You share your wisdom with us. You direct talented young people, young potential scholars, to come to Yale as students or as faculty members. When you serve your communities, you're an example of what a Yale education can do, and therefore you inspire our students and other young people from all over the world who might come to Yale, and that is a wonderful thing, and that's why you're such an important aspect of the Yale, larger Yale community. So let me conclude by thanking you for joining us this evening for our Yale Explorers event. We've done one of these in Washington on a different topic, now in Boston, and next year we plan several more, so please give us your feedback. And I look forward to talking to you and seeing you right now at the reception. But before we leave, can you join me in thanking Carl and our three faculty members for a really stimulating panel? Thank you so much. See you all outside where we have some different snacks for you.
Please be sure to visit the Yale Explorers video booth and share your story. Thank you and have a good evening.